I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Thank you, Ken, and once again, it's a pleasure to be here.
Today, we promise to cover in some detail what you should have as your investment objectives and buying criteria. But before doing that, I wonder if you might first talk about the mindset that different types of investors could have.
Over the years, from my experience, until you work out what your mindset is and what type of investor you are or the profile that you have as far as investment is concerned, it's very difficult to move forward. And you know, if we start talking about some of these technical issues like investment objectives and buying criteria, well, it sort of doesn't mean so much. So what I've found over the years is that investors tend to fall into three fundamental categories. Now, the first type of investor is one of those, and we all know them, the ones that love to tell stories about how they gambled the lot and that either go broke or make a fortune. And they tend to only talk about the times when they made money, a bit like horse race people. You only hear about the winning bets, not the losing ones. Anyway, look, those people are fun to be around, but, you know, it's not someone you want to emulate. Because remember, if you go for broke, there's a very good chance, if you don't have options and think the thing through, that that's exactly where you'll end up. Now, the second type of investor is what you might affectionately call an armchair investor. And they always have logic and reason behind them, and they probably attend loads of seminars and subscribe to newsletters and can always answer all those most technical questions about the economy. And the trouble is they never really pluck up enough courage to go out and invest. And they're the ones that generally keep their money in the bank or something really secure and don't want to take too much risk. And that's not a criticism. It's just understand if you are that type of person. But then there's a third type, which is what I would call a mildly aggressive investor. And that's the person who looks to increase their portfolio investments only when they have sufficient funds in reserve. In other words, they're not into borrowing to buy shares. They don't want to create a large exposure. So unless you've got fundamental, strong underlying security, they don't engage in debt very aggressively. So they don't want to put all their properties at risk just because one deal seemed to be great. They're what you call prudent, careful, well-planned investors. Now, where do you start? I suppose to get the right mindset, what you need to do is to look at your assets and liabilities, draw up a statement of position, as it were. Now, this is to establish what your net worth is. And at some point, if you are going for a loan, you're going to have to do this anyway. So it's not a bad place to start to get a feeling and get a comfort level, if you like, because, I mean, you might think you don't have a lot of assets, but by the time you add up what your home is worth and some shares you've got and your car and the outstanding loans, you might suddenly find that you've actually got a net worth of, you know, $500,000, you know, by the time you include your weekend at a beach home or something like that. It suddenly adds up. And the purpose of that is if you're going to, let's say you surprise yourself and you've actually got a net worth of $800,000. So if you're going out to buy a property for $500,000 or let's say $700,000 and you're going to borrow $400,000 of that, the borrowing of $400,000 is only a relatively small proportion, because if you're going to buy a house for six, you already have a net worth of eight. So you're going to add another $6,000 to your net worth and then take off the borrowing. So you're adding a net $200,000. So actually you're increasing your net worth to about $1 million, from $800,000 to $1 million, notwithstanding that you've just entered into a $400,000 loan. So it's a matter of having a an overview of your assets and your liabilities so that you get your investment plans in perspective. So as you step into the market, if you're looking to invest in a property under $1 million, the marketplace generally would term you as an amateur investor, certainly someone with money, but probably not having a lot of commercial property experience. Now, that doesn't preclude you, because there are a number of strata title offices that you can buy in the $350,000 to $600,000 bracket quite comfortably. I mean, in many respects, that's not much different to what you'd pay for an apartment that you would lease out. The only difference being, instead of getting a 3.25% return, you're getting closer to 7.5% net return. So it's not until you get over $1 million that you are considered to be more of the professional type, where you're getting into perhaps shops, warehouses, and maybe even larger office properties. So hopefully that provides you with an overview of the thinking and the planning and the crystallisation of the correct mindset.
Okay, now that's laid the foundation. Now perhaps you might explain the importance of having sound objectives and exactly what you feel that they should be.
Well, Ken, investment objectives are where you need to start. If you don't have those right, you're fundamentally flawed and in danger of not recognising good from bad as you move forward. When you start your investment strategy, you have to have these underlying investment objectives, and maybe I'll just quickly run through the 8 objectives and I'll cover them in a bit more detail. But initially it's enduring value, ongoing cash flow, steady growth, what I term super growth, that's above market growth, lending appeal, future collateral, cost control and tax benefits. So let's start with the first one, enduring value. Now, what we're talking about here is there is no value at all if it's only in the first tenure. In other words, if the property's new, but after the first 3 to 5 years, it's not going to stand the test of time. And so you've got to have a property, and this comes down to making the decision at the outset, and this is probably where you need to put together a team of consultants to advise you both on the marketplace and also the building design and construction itself. But by picking a property that will have value in the second and third and fourth letting, in other words, yes, it might need a bit of tricking up, but fundamentally it has tenant appeal. And that's what's terribly important, that the property itself is so crucial, more so than the actual location. People get bent out of shape over location, but it's no good having the best located property that's unlettable. If we move on to ongoing cash flow, having it well located is certainly an added benefit, of course, but it's not a guarantee of continued income. And so you need to balance out its position with its design, with its adaptability, so that moving forward, you know that you're not going to have an interrupted cash flow if the tenant leaves. And let's face it, you want to think the tenant will be there for life, but the reality is that at some point, whether it's during your ownership or afterwards when you sell it, that tenant is going to move. So you have to have a property that will provide you with ongoing leasing potential. The third one is steady growth. Now, what you need to look at is that the marketplace will grow over time. Now, and that is with inflation. Inflation's pretty much under control at the moment, but you need to ensure that it will grow over time. Now, growth in value is a combination of two things. One, rental increases, and two, a firming of the selling yield as the market improves. And so you need to be aware of how those two factors interplay, and that partly comes down to the lease structure as to whether there are built-in rent increases over the period, the level of rent currently as to whether it is under or over the present market value, and therefore looking forward, whether you can anticipate a steady growth over time. The next type of growth is what we call super growth, and that is where you come up with an idea or an angle that the property has or could provide down the track that would enable you to add value greater than what the market will provide. In other words, it might be a change of use, it may be a larger property that could be subdivided into floor by floor if it's multiple floors, or if it's a single floor into multiple tenancies or separate titles on the one floor, or it, as I said, a change of use. It may be currently an older warehouse, but because of the way the whole neighbourhood is changing, it could become a trendy restaurant, which again is a higher use than an industrial use and therefore attracts a higher rental. So it's keeping your eyes peeled for opportunities where you can add value but not with a lot of expense involved. Or certainly for every dollar you spend, you get at least 3 to 5, hopefully more, back, and change the current use into something that is higher and better. Now, the next investment objective, it relates to lending appeal. Now, this is where you start to look at your property as a banker does. And you've always got to keep your financier happy. And so you've got to take a look at, and it's not just the property, it is the lease. So in other words, some properties you get mesmerised, you can buy them off the plan and the developer will provide you with a 6-month rent guarantee, maybe even a 12-month rent guarantee. The problem with that is that as new and attractive as the property might be and as well located as it might be, it's not a bankable proposition, because a valuer and a financier will not take any comfort, particularly in the present market, of a 6 or 12 month rent guarantee, because they know the developer has effectively built it into the price. Some of the things I've negotiated with my clients has been a 3-year rent guarantee that it's called a pre-lease rent guarantee. In other words, if the property remains vacant, the vendor will pay the rent to you as though it were tenanted for 3 years. However, as soon as they find a tenant, that tenant is substituted in lieu of that rent guarantee. Now, the advantage of that is that if a vendor is on the hook for 3 years, you know they're going to be motivated to find a tenant as soon as possible. If they're only there for 6 months or maybe 12, chances are they will just look at that as a contingent liability. They've got it built into the price, so what's it matter? We have no motivation to find a tenant. Let the purchaser solve that problem themselves. So you've got to look at it, as I said, as a financier does, and is it a bankable transaction? And that leads on to the next investment objective, and that is future collateral. Now, buying it today is one thing, but you won't hold every property forever, but there's going to be a certain number of properties that will form the core of your ongoing portfolio. And the idea being that those are such good properties, and they're not necessarily large properties, but they are properties that are highly lettable, continue to grow in value, get good rent increases, are easily adaptable, and as and when the mortgage on those properties falls due, because of the steady increase in growth or even maybe some super growth you've been able to inject, you can refinance them, release cash from those properties, and therefore go out and buy other properties. So they become part of your underlying net worth to help build your portfolio even larger. So in addition to any further cash you inject or comes available to buy further property, what we're talking about is this core group of properties, and you should look at properties along those lines. Some properties you might say, I can do something clever in that the lease is going to fall due in 3 years' time. I can completely modernise it, let it, and that would be the time to sell it with a brand new lease. That may be not one of these properties, but you need to assess each property to see where it fits either in the core part of your portfolio or something that you intend to make a medium-term gain out of by doing something clever. The next objective is cost control. Now, you might have a secure rental stream, but if you don't have the tenant paying the outgoings, then you have an exposure. And that's the sort of thing you have with residential property, because it's not until the end of the financial year with an apartment do you know how much you have available or how much you've made out of the property. With commercial property, if the leases are properly structured, the tenant pays the outgoing. So whatever you receive each month, you can effectively bank and spend because your costs are under control. And this is the sort of thing that you've got to look at with rates and taxes and insurance and even maintenance and those sort of things growing every year. You need to know that they're covered so that you receive each month a net figure that you can count on and meet your commitments accordingly. Now, the final objective is tax benefits. And a lot of people are surprised that that's the last on the list. As important as it is, it should never be the principal reason for you entering into a transaction to purchase a property. If you're looking for tax benefits solely, you want to go into one of these end-of-year schemes, if that's what the sort of thing you're after, with pine trees or whatever, where you get maximum tax benefits. You will get some considerable tax benefits with commercial property. You will get accelerated depreciation. Generally, it's in the first 5 years that you get your benefit, and that's why for most of my clients, I recommend that they have a four-year mandatory review of all their properties, because that's the point at which you have claimed the maximum depreciation. Now, that is a significant non-cash outgoing, which enhances your bottom line. Need to do it properly. You have to get the appropriate quantity surveyor tax schedules, but it can be a very, very attractive proposition. But as I said, that should never be the reason you go into a deal. It's a bonus. All other things being in line, tax benefits then swing in and make it the icing on top of the cake.
Let's now move on to what might be your appropriate buying criteria.
Yes, sure, Ken, because these buying criteria link very closely with your investment objectives. And I'll quickly go through them, and I might group some of them together because there are 12 of them, and it'll just make it a bit easier. But tenant calibre and lease term, as you can see, link closely together, and these probably will be are the most important in ensuring that you achieve your objectives that we talked about just a moment ago. And so you want a good quality tenant. It doesn't have to be a major corporate or a government, but a good quality tenant with a minimum of ideally a five-year lease. But if it's a smaller property, a three-year lease, if it's brand new, is fine. Then you want to look at recent construction and flexible design. So, you know, if a property is recently built, that will have ongoing appeal to subsequent tenants, good tax depreciations we discussed. You'd have less worries about having to maintain and renovate the property. Also, the design, if it's flexible, means that you've got an efficient floor layout, so if the tenant leaves, you can then subdivide it, even if you only do separate tenancies, not even separate titles, but it means that you not have a lot of space lost with passageways and things like that. And then you look at the lease structure and absence of competition. Now, the lease structure relates to things like the frequency and method of your rent reviews. In other words, who pays the operating costs and to what degree the tenant's responsible for all the building outgoings and maintenance, which we discussed as far as cost control. Now, the absence of competition relates to how many similar properties there are or could be built nearby. Now, this is where you determine whether or not you're going to have a lot of competition when a tenant leaves. In other words, the market's going to be oversaturated because there's other properties available and there are vacancies in the area. Then we look at good position and emerging trends. Now, remember I said location's not important? Well, that's why it's effectively down here at number eight. I mean, all other things being equal, obviously you want a good location, but it's not the most important. I mean, the things that are important are, you know, it's access to public transport and its overall visibility as far as a tenant's concerned. Now, when you talk about emerging trends, we're talking about demographic movements and population movements, and also whether or not an area is becoming trendy. And I don't mean that in a trite way, but it's becoming favourable. It's becoming a spot where office people want to congregate. In other words, its location has become a very favourable for executives. And so that in the whole scheme of things, you've got to look at items that in these trends, it might be construction, it might be how the building is built as far as its energy efficiency and lighting, and the amount of technology it's got in it. So even though it's an older building, it might have been completely gutted, refurbished, rebuilt, and it's actually got later technology than a building that was built 2-3 years ago. So that's important because you're looking at the trends that are going to be useful for you down the track in future lettings. And then you've got as buying criteria your passing yield and your zoning. Now, your passing yield refers to the net return you're getting each year. Now, you've got to be careful when you're comparing properties because if your rent is under the market, it means that the property, if your rental is above market and you're buying at the same yield as a property where the rent is at market, it means you've paid too much. And it also means that in future rent reviews that you are not going to get the same level of increase when the market review comes around because it's already too high. And likewise, if it's underlet and tied to fixed reviews, it means your rent is going to be escalating on automatic reviews, say at 3% per annum or 3.5%, at a slower market, and the gap between market rent and your rent will actually grow in size. So it's important that you look at that because it could have some effect on your super growth, which we talked about before. Now, things like zoning is your potential and future uses. And this doesn't necessarily mean anticipating changes in the planning scheme. It's more just ensuring that things that you have in mind are capable of being implemented within the current zoning. If you have an upgrade in the zoning, that's a bonus. But you need to know that you can change the use and it's permitted. It's something you need to get on top of. It's not complicated. In the sort of properties that you'd be looking at in the office or industrial, there's probably only a handful of zonings you have to get to know. Again, if you get the right consulting team, they can give you a crash course in half an hour of what you can and can't do, probably extracts of the appropriate zonings, so that you can very quickly get on top of it. And the final couple of things are title options and vendor motivation. Now, a surveyor will quickly tell you, with very little expense, whether or not you can subdivide a property. And that's a real bonus, that you get one title and you can further subdivide it into smaller titles. Now, whether it's a block of land or an office floor, it doesn't matter. Even though you've got one tenant at the moment, you can still subdivide it. And when the lease falls due, even if the tenant stays on, part of the deal might be you'll give them a slight concession on the rent if they'll sign up 2 or 3 separate leases to align those with the titles. Because immediately you do that, it means that you have the opportunity to sell one or more of those separately rather than having to sell the whole lot. And you'll always get a greater relative price per square metre for the smaller components than you will for the whole lot. But even having said that, if you do sell the whole lot down the track, the mere fact that you have 2 or 3 or more titles instead of the one big title, the incoming purchaser sees that as a far lower risk and will pay you a higher price, not perhaps as much as if you sold them individually, but a far higher price for the comfort of knowing if they ever get caught down the track, they could sell off one or more of the titles to reduce their debt. And the final buying criteria is the vendor motivation. Now, obviously a motivated vendor is important, but again, it's a bit like tax benefits. It's down the bottom of the list because a motivated vendor for a lousy property is of no value. You know, it's only cheap if it's going to work for you down the future and grow in value. So a motivated vendor is again, that little bit of extra bonus where everything else falls into place and you then have the opportunity to do an extra good deal.
Chris, you've covered a fair amount today, and I think it might be helpful next week if you were to start by telling our listeners exactly how to tie all of this together.